Hello, everybody, and welcome back to an all-new episode of Dirtcast. I am your co-host, Madeline Davies.
And I am your other co-host, Megan Reynolds.
And we have a very interesting show for you today. Mm-hmm. It's one of the more historic lookbacks at old Hollywood.
Old Hollywood.
Our dear friend, Jezebel staff writer Kelly Faircloth, will be here to discuss the history of the casting couch and the way that female actresses have long been associated with sex work.
It's this weird concept that does a lot of heavy lifting culturally because it simultaneously acknowledges the potential for sexual abuse. It reframes sexual abuse as a question of like what the woman did. And it also has this sort of power to question the achievements of women, to be like, oh, you know, is she a casting couch case?
Maddie?
Yes.
How are you?
I'm good. It's a fall day, kind of, for the first time today. Both of us have our leather jackets.
And our matching black tote bags.
A couple T-birds. We're in like a 50s gang.
That's us.
There's a chill in the air.
Mm-hmm.
I think both of us are for it.
I'm super excited.
We're both wearing sweaters.
I feel cozy. I'm very cozy. I'm wearing socks, and I'm not mad about it, which is weird, because usually I hate socks.
Yeah, you historically hate socks.
No, if there's one thing to know about me, it's that I fucking hate socks.
I did bend my sunglasses on the way here, as
tragedy,
I showed you.
Tragedy.
But we've decided that I am not going to try to fix it.
Correct.
Which I think is like a mature decision.
I think so, too, because I feel like the instinct would be like, I can do this. And just,
yeah,
and then the
I would bend it back. Yes.
You'd end up with two hands full of sunglasses, which is not what you want.
So I feel like I've grown up and being like, you know what? I'm going to take this to a professional. They're going to bend that arm back for me.
Yep.
I don't know what that costs.
Nothing.
I hope.
It's free because you're not like asking them to like fix the lens or like, I want a new frame. You're just like, they stick it in a thing and then
it's
you
done.
Leave.
The other day, I had to go fill up my bike tires. And like, that makes it sound like I'm a city biker, but really, I had to fill them up because they were completely flat from
just,
never
like,
riding
dead.
It because
right.
I'm so afraid. People here are crazy.
People here are insane. I would never ride a bicycle on these streets.
Yeah. So it's very nerve-wracking, but I don't want to like get rid of my bike.
Same here.
So they just had completely flat tires, mm-hmm. and I had to move it.
Oh.
And so I went into a bike shop and I was like, hey, do you guys just have an air pump I could use?
Mm.
And the guy like very reluctantly gave it to
me. What?
When I was done, I was like, well, thank you so much. Do you guys like want some money for that?
Uh-huh.
And he looked at me like I was an idiot.
What?
And I was like, well, yeah.
What a strange exchange.
And at first I was like, is this like the rare example of like girl privilege where I expected to just go in and be like, like, can I have it?
Oh, interesting.
And then they were like, no, you like
no,
used
like,
our services.
$5 or whatever, right?
I think I just said, I was like, is a $5 donation okay?
Oh my God. I don't think I've ever paid for, I mean, I have a bicycle also. I have not ridden it in 5 to 6 years. It lives behind the couch. Just in case.
Yeah, it is the best way to escape, like, an apocalyptic situation.
Yep. A bike of an old-ass Schwinn that weighs, like, 40 pounds with flat tires.
Yep.
That's exactly what I'll use. When they come for us, I'll be on that bike.
A zombie won't bite you because they'll be like, really?
Like, oh, God, she's really riding that?
Yeah, that's cute.
But every time I've filled up its stupid tires, which has been, I think, once, it's been free.
Yeah, I guess you can use, like, a pump at a gas station.
Yeah. But a bike, they'll sometimes have one, like, outside.
Yeah. I'm from, again, like, as I talk about a lot, I'm from Madison, Wisconsin, where it's just, like, everyone's like, you're riding your bike? Cool. Like, you want us to fix your tire for you? You know, it's,
oh
like,
God.
It's all, everyone, like, is so stoked that you're riding a bike. That
not here.
No.
You get no, like, stoked points
yes.
for riding a bicycle here. And people are just like, oh.
But enough about the broken things in my life.
Yes.
How are you?
I am doing great. I recently redecorated my bedroom.
I saw it. It looks really good.
Thank you. My best friend and his boyfriend came over. They're my personal contractors. We were calling them the property lovers. They did not. They didn't like that.
No.
No, it's weird, but no, they weren't into that.
No, I get it.
It seems fine. I kept screaming like property lovers. And they're like, okay, Megan, like we're drilling into your bedroom wall right now. But they're really nice shelves. I got a new plant. I guess I'm never leaving my apartment. I'll probably die there, which is fine. There's a funeral home.
Yeah. There's a literal funeral home downstairs.
Yep. So. I live above a funeral home. So if I do happen to expire in my apartment, we can just whoever's left can just sort of slide me down.
I was going to say, just kind of tumble you down the stairs.
Yeah, it'll be really easy. So that was good. I did that. It was too hot on the day that I did it because this weekend was very warm.
It was muggy.
Muggy, like disgusting.
I get why the weather is being this way.
Same.
But I also...
I hate it.
Hate it.
But today's beautiful. I'm wearing a sweater. Maddie's wearing a sweater. We're twins. Life is just fine. It's nice. It was so cold last night that I had to close my window.
Ooh.
I woke up and was like, I'm freezing.
They definitely closed my window. Turned our heat on already.
Oh, they did?
Well, I guess legally they have to.
Oh, fuck. That's what I'm afraid of. I hate that. Because, I mean, it just spews out like dead skin and like bug parts and like dust.
Yeah.
And then everyone sneezes for like 3 months. And then it's 85 degrees inside your home while it's snowing outside, ideally.
Yes. Do you have radiator heat?
Yeah, I fucking hate it. I can't turn it. I've tried. I can't, like, turn it off.
And it still gets hot even if you turn it off.
I've tried everything.
Yeah.
Short of, like, ripping them out, which is perhaps what I'll do this winter.
Yeah, lose your deposit, but stay cool.
Who knew? I mean,
and again, you're dying there.
And I'm dying. Yeah, exactly. When I rip it out, there'll be a hole to the funeral home.
So
we'll just make a little ladder and then we'll have a little trap door for it.
Mm.
And so when I or one of my roommates or, God forbid, one of the cats perishes, since the cats are obviously getting like a funeral, like a regular funeral,
of course.
Obviously, they'll just go down the thing and then embalmed, then a little cat casket. Really cute.
It's very Sweeney Todd.
It is.
Just have a little chute on your floor.
I love it. I mean, you know, we'll see.
Also, speaking of Sweeney Todd, yesterday I was so successfully trolled by our coworkers who were just like talking shit about Stephen Sondheim just to make me mad.
This was incredible to witness.
And I knew that they were doing this. I knew they were doing it to upset me. And even
yet,
now I'm getting so mad.
I was sitting next to Maddie, as I do every day at the office, and I could feel there was like a vibrating sort of like energy coming off of your body. And I was like, oh no, it's working. It's
I know. Working. They were just needling. And it's like what I do to them all the time. So I can't even really be mad at them about it. But I am so mad at them.
They were just going through the names of his musicals, like off the Wikipedia page and being like, The Frogs?
Yeah.
What's this?
That sounds stupid.
It's amazing.
What does it even mean to write the lyrics to something? I was like...
It was so good.
What did Julianne say that maybe got me?
Oh,
she murdered me. She said something along the lines of, I don't like Stephen Sondheim because I only like dystopian 70s musicals about bad relationships and West Side Story.
Oh, my God. And then you screamed, like, Folly!
I was like, Folly's in company! I was like, and he wrote the lyrics of West Side Story!
Oh, my God. It was a very tense 15. I want to say that exchange went on.
Too long.
I think it was at most 15 minutes, but it did feel like most of the afternoon.
Oh, my God. I'm the worst.
It was wonderful. It was really nice.
Yeah. So if you want to know how to, like, actually drive me crazy.
Send her emails about Stephen, like, bad emails about Stephen Sondheim. That's, like, the one way. Like, that will crack, like, that cracks the exterior, gets right to, like, the mushy center of the thing.
Yeah, right. If you want to see me, like, just destroyed. It's so easy, it turns out.
That's your kryptonite.
Ugh.
Oh, boy.
Megan.
Maddie.
Would you like to get into the dirtiest dirt?
Oh, my God. I would love to. The dirt this week is kind of like, all of the dirt is tainted by Harvey Weinstein.
Sweat all over it.
He sweat, exactly. There's like eczema flakes in it. It's all him. That was disgusting. That was actually really gross. I'm super sorry about that.
I mean, but we can start with the nicer things.
There are two nice things.
Well, one's not nice and one's okay.
Oh, yeah. Well, one is like kind of like, huh? So the thing that is not nice but happened is that Robert Pattinson and FKA Twigs, who were previously engaged, broke up, apparently.
And they were together for a minute.
Like a couple of years, at least. 2 to 3, I want to say.
At least 3.
Right? Like, did he date her after Kristen Stewart? Or was there like an
in the middle.
Some stuff between?
Yeah.
They, to me, always felt like a very unlikely couple.
See, to me, they always made sense.
Oh, walk me through this.
So not so secretly love Robert Pattinson.
Okay.
Not his acting or anything. I just think that he has a charm.
He does.
And I think what, like, got me is, like, there's a supercut of him, like, making fun of Twilight in interviews.
Oh, that's amazing.
And he just is, like, very dry and witty and, like, very self-aware of it all.
When I read it, it seemed like it was a book that wasn't supposed to be published.
It was so long.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Yeah, and we were shooting it forever.
If Edward was not a fictional character and you just met him in reality, you know, he's one of those guys who'd be like an axe murderer.
There's a lot of books in the Cullen household, but know what to expect when you're expecting a half vampire child.
No, they look on Google Images. That was one of the funniest scenes I've ever had to do in my life. It's like, really? We're all like 300 year old geniuses. And we just go, it's like, vampire baby, like on Google Images. And yeah, that was our research into it. It's like, I can't find anything.
This was probably 10 years ago that I saw it. And I was like, oh, he's actually like very cute and very charming.
Okay.
And funny.
Right.
And then I think he's made really interesting choices since
then. Post-Twilight.
So I do think he's, like a decent actor, too. And then it always struck me that he, I think, like, is into, like, kind of cool underground arty stuff.
Right, like London cool fun things, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it, like, made sense that he would, like, be into someone who's, like, the embodiment of that.
Yeah.
And who also seems lovely.
She does seem lovely. I really only thought about Robert Pattinson as the sparkly vampire, and then I, like, kind of forgot that he existed, which I think was maybe probably what he might have wanted, because I feel like all the press that I've read, what was the movie that he was just in? Good Time. A singular time, right?
Yeah.
Because all of the press that came out, like that GQ cover and all that stuff around, he was saying how like his life, like he couldn't do anything because of like paparazzi and Twilight and bullshit.
The one story where he was just like, all I wanted was a hot dog, but I couldn't go outside to the cart to get it.
I can leave. Who's that man? Is that a hot dog? New York hot dog. The kind that makes you fall in love.
So, I mean, I think that me personally forgetting about him was like in tribute to what he wanted.
Yeah.
But well, I also just like didn't think about him for a while.
And then
while.
He was like making like weird Fincher movies and that type. Yeah. Like he was doing like kind of more.
He was like growing, like experimenting.
Yeah.
Like growing up in front of us.
Yep. Look at him. Look at him go.
But they were engaged.
He was one time Cedric Diggory and now.
Oh my God, that's right. R.I.P. Cedric Diggory.
My boy!
Get up. Easy. Easy. This is not where you want to be right now.
She just spoiled the end of book four.
These are the hard truths that you come to Dirtcast for.
It's true. These
were Harry Potter spoilers from like 10 years ago.
Yeah, right. Things that could not be counted
things
as spoilers
that you
in
definitely,
any way.
No, but for anyone who has not read Harry Potter, I'm really sorry.
Yeah, I mean, it's fine.
It's okay. I mean, you have time.
Yeah. They're still really good.
They are. They hold up. But they broke up. They were engaged. And now they are no longer together.
Well, and may they both find happiness.
May they both find happiness. I'm sure this is for the best.
Who was it who, like, broke the news of their engagement? It was someone really unexpected. T-Pain. It was T-Pain.
It was T-Pain?
Okay, yeah. So
what?
T-Pain is the one who, like, broke the news about their engagement. Because he had an interview with Vulture.
Okay.
And he, like, said something about he's, like, oh, yeah, like, they're engaged. Like, he basically was like, yeah, FKA Twigs and Patty. He kept calling Robert Pattinson Patty.
Just what I call Robert Pattinson.
I love it. They asked something about FKA Twigs. He responded that she was engaged, and then they asked him to clarify. And his response was, yeah, to old Patty. But then the interview came out on April Fool's Day, and he was, like, clearly not supposed to say that.
Yeah.
So then he tried to backtrack and say it was an April Fool's joke, which is very an obscure and weird.
Like, a
April
very
Fool's
random,
joke.
Like, not a joke that, like, would not land. Like, why?
Yeah.
Who is the audience for that? Like, what are you doing? That's not how you do an April Fool's joke.
And then I think they were just like, the jig is up.
Oh,
they went to the Met Ball. She
right.
wore an engagement ring.
That's right. I remember this now.
Well. Yeah.
They're no more. Maybe it was T-Pain's fault. Maybe the cause of all of the, you know, the undercurrent of strife that may have ran through their relationship was a result of T-Pain.
They just, like, have been, like, living too under the microscope since he said that.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Some good news that does not involve a breakup, but involves an engagement. One of the Jonas brothers.
Joe.
The one with the mustache.
Ja-Jonas.
Ja-Jonas. Ja-Jonas is engaged to Sophie Turner.
AKA Sansa Stark.
Sansa Stark.
Very young.
Both parties. Well, how old is
Joe Jonas, I think.
Ja-Jonas is like
my age, I think. Right. Maybe a little bit younger.
And then, but Sansa.
So I'd say he's like, I'm 30. I would say he's like 28.
Okay, I would take that. But I think Sophie Turner is like 20. Blah, blah.
Yeah, 20, 21 maybe.
Right. Like, yeah.
But you know what?
You grow up fast in Hollywood.
Engaged ain't married.
Engaged ain't married. I mean, listen, as evidenced by our first item.
Yeah.
You never know.
Also, go have fun, you guys.
Enjoy your lives.
You know, have a ring, flash it around.
She did. They put it on Instagram.
You know, and she on television has had so many bad engagements that I hope that this one is blessed.
I think this is
the exact opposite.
I think this is great. I hope Nick Jonas sings Jealous with a gospel choir at their wedding. Just because I really like that song and I know it's not appropriate for a wedding, but I think that would be nice.
The Joe Bros used to hang out a lot around the old office. So you would always like be at the bodega behind Joe Jonas or that type of thing.
How many are there? There's Joe.
Yeah.
Nick blank. Kevin?
Kevin.
Wow.
Kevin, who's now a real estate magnate in New Jersey.
Yeah. Is Joe the one that's in that band?
D-N-C-E.
Dince.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, good. I don't like them, but good for him.
I think my mom likes them.
Oh.
Which, so.
Sure.
They're enjoyed by someone.
Okay.
She's going to text me and be like, I do not like them. I only said I like one song.
So that is great for them. It's nice to see that love can still thrive in this flaming hellscape that is 2017.
Love can thrive, as can hate.
Love and hate.
So what we're going to move on to, is you should never inspire the wrath of Carrie Fisher.
Nope.
Who is no longer with us, sadly, but whose presence continues to delight in her own way.
Mm-hmm.
An exec at Sony had a history of sexually harassing women.
Mm-hmm.
Carrie Fisher warned her friend Heather Ross about it and then also mailed a beef tongue to the producer, warning him to not bother Heather Ross.
Yeah, she personally delivered. This is what she said to her friend who was recounting this.
And I asked her, I was like, okay, well, what was inside? She's like, it was a cow tongue from the Jerry's Famous Deli in Westwood with a note that said, if you ever touch my darling Heather or any other woman again, the next delivery will be something of yours in a much smaller box. And I about died.
God, what an angel. Fuck.
There's a heaven. She's in it.
She really is, because I just, the execution.
Yeah.
Everything about
the wit.
The wit. Very short, to the point, like exactly what you needed. Like, and I'm sure that producer was, I mean, God knows he's probably, I mean.
He's probably still out fondling today.
He's probably, exactly. He's still out a fondling, but.
But at least like we have this one moment.
Yeah.
It's nice that like as women, like things are always like not going to be in our favor. But then it's like there's like little things.
Yeah, there are little like nibbles that are like thrown up to you. They're like, ah, yes, okay.
Thank you.
Thanks. It's like the universe attempting to like fix shit. And then something larger happens and you're like, oh, never mind. You like fall off the cliff again.
But you gotta enjoy those moments. You gotta savor them.
Yes, because you store them like precious jewels.
Yeah.
Because
just hoard them away.
Just look at them
your
every
gnarled
night.
Gnarled little goblin fists.
Speaking of gnarled goblins, my favorite goblin, Woody Allen.
You love him.
I am obsessed. No, I'm just kidding. It's fine.
We should clarify that. Megan is kidding.
I am joking. He's weighed in on the Harvey Weinstein situation because we were all definitely waiting for fucking Woody Allen to say something about this situation. Like, if there's
who should weigh in?
Out of all the people.
I know.
Woody Allen.
This other perv.
So he initially said that he felt sad for everyone involved, including Weinstein, the women, etc. And then he also said, you don't want it to lead to a witch hunt atmosphere, a Salem atmosphere, where every guy in an office who winks at a woman is suddenly having to call a lawyer to defend himself.
Ugh. Also, here's the thing with the phrase witch hunt.
Mm.
It's not a witch hunt when the person's guilty.
Mm-hmm.
That's like a manhunt.
That's a manhunt. You're hunting for, exactly.
It's also just like a witch hunt like implies that there are people who are not fucking up. But
right.
It's like, heaven forbid, all of the men who are sexually harassing their employees, heaven forbid that they end up with the spotlight shown on them.
Yep.
Like, that's not the same thing.
It's not. And I mean, again, no one was asking for Woody Allen's opinion on this. No one needed Woody Allen's opinion on this. No one needs Woody Allen's opinion on anything. I feel like he should just sort of fade. He's like 80 whatever years old. He should just fade quietly into the distance, continue making like his one like dumb movie a year and like shitting out another fucking Amazon series. And then that's it. And just like do that. People will still pay you money. He has money. Like,
how about we don't give him money though?
We could cut that off.
What if like if he does keep making movies? Mm. He can only make the good ones that happen every 4 years.
Interesting.
And even then, it's like, no, all of your money has to go to, like, Rain.
Oh, okay.
So on Twitter, there was that guy who's the co-star of The Tick, Griffin Newman, went on a very long thread about how he is going to have a very small part in this upcoming Woody Allen movie. It's already filmed.
Yeah, the one with Kate Winslet.
Yeah.
Wonder Wheel.
He always felt very uncomfortable with the idea of doing it, but it also felt like there were reasons why he talked himself out of feeling reluctant for it.
Oh, boy.
Which, honestly, I can empathize with.
The, like, push-pull of, like, should I? Yeah.
Well, and it's, like, because we've all, like, worked with bad people.
Of course.
Because it's, like, something that,
because you just like,
maybe there's something we want out of it.
Of
you know,
course.
Like, I doubt there's anybody who out there who can say that they've like never put aside their morals for something self-serving.
I feel like I put aside my morals once a day, honestly.
But in light of the Weinstein thing, he came out and he was like, basically, I'm working with an accused rapist.
Mm-hmm.
I believe his accuser.
Mm-hmm.
I did this for XYZ reasons, which I know are shallow.
Mm.
And then he said that he's donating his entire salary to
Rain. Good for him.
Which I also, I think a lot of people like went after him and were kind of were like, well, why did you work with him in the first place?
Oh.
And he very much explained that.
He like showed his work, it sounds like. What went through.
And how do we expect people to apologize?
That's the larger question, I think.
That sort of seems like the problem where it's like the expectation is that you never fuck up, which is just impossible.
Of course,
we're
like, human beings.
Yeah, we're like a bunch of like dumb, angry, violent chimps.
Yep.
And so this guy, like, made a mistake. He regretted it at the time. He regrets it now.
Mm-hmm.
He's doing, like, probably the nicest, like, the most aggressive way that you can, like, try to make up for it.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I just think it seems really stupid to, like, then
to, like,
go after him.
To, like, glom on him for, like, why did you take this in the first place? Like, that's fine. I guess people, like, annoyed that he, like, tweeted through it instead of, like, issuing just, like, a statement?
Yeah. I mean, maybe, but he's not really like big enough to have
right.
a statement.
Like,
so.
I only knew his name because of this thing. And I've heard about the tick for like the past 3 months.
Right.
I don't fucking understand what it is, nor do I want to. So,
yeah,
I'm
I don't
good
know.
There.
I just think it's like he like came clean.
Yeah.
But he fucked up. He's trying to make up for it. And it's really screwy to then just be like,
yeah.
I mean, I guess you can apologize and no one is forced to forgive you.
Correct.
But it does seem very weird that this was a thing that no one knew about. And then
right.
it's like he like went about it in the responsible way.
People are so dumb.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and people are like pissed off. And
yeah.
so it's easy to like, especially on Twitter, throw your anger around.
Right.
At, you know, but just like be mad at Woody Allen.
Yeah,
don't be mad at this guy.
Who
like,
is like owning up to like the decision that he made, explaining why he made the decision that he made, and then donating his salary from this stupid movie about the fucking Coney Island and Kate Winslet to Rain.
I'm sure that like none of these people who are going after him, I'm sure they've never went and seen a Woody Allen movie, never paid for one, never
definitely never seen Annie Hall.
Yeah, never like, you know, witnessed anything made by an alleged sexual predator or
right.
harasser.
Right.
It's just like, everyone's so full of shit.
Everyone is extremely full of shit. And I think the sooner that we all admit freely that we are full of shit,
yeah,
world will be a better place.
I think that's what Griffin Newman kind of did.
God bless him. He started it.
Yeah.
Woody Allen, just, I'd like to see, I just want to clarify, I guess, that his dumb comments about dumb Harvey Weinstein, he clarified them to be like, I wasn't actually defending him. Said, when I said I felt sad for Harvey Weinstein, I thought it was clear the meaning was because he is a sad, sick man. I was surprised it was treated differently. Lest there be any ambiguity, this statement clarifies my intention and feelings.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Like, go back to your fucking gross, like, brown couch. I feel like he just sits on a brown couch and it smells like stale coffee and, like, sadness. And he just sits there and, like, types at a typewriter. And then he takes a nap. Then he wakes up. Eats like one of those gross like Ryvita crackers, those really dry ones.
Yeah.
A very specific
Where's Sun Yi in all this?
Huh?
Where's Sun Yi in all of this?
She's making the crackers.
Oh, making them.
She's in the kitchen. She's putting cottage cheese on the crackers.
I think also the thing that actually bugs me about his statement isn't the whole like feeling sorry for Harvey Weinstein
yeah.
thing. It's the witch hunt thing.
Yeah, that's
like,
unnecessary.
That's what I come back to where it's like, that's where you're defending somebody.
Yeah.
You're not, it's not like saying like, you feel bad for this person because,
right.
I mean, in a weird way, I get that. And that
sure
it's like,
yeah,
he, like, this guy is as much a victim of the patriarchy as the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
but also victimized way more people, you know?
Right.
So it's like that part of the statement doesn't even get my hackles up as nearly as much as, like, being like, worry about the men. What about the other men of Hollywood who have gotten away with everything for years?
Right. People could stand to not talk.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Like
we say as we talk endlessly.
I just think that some people who are currently speaking out at this very troubling time could stand to think, everyone could stand to think about what they're going to say before they say it.
Yeah, and how that will maybe reflect back on them.
Yes, and just think for like, run it. There has got to be someone who in these people's camps that are like, hey, are you going to say this thing? I don't know. Maybe just like say something else or don't.
Yeah.
Let's go over here and you not talk.
I guess it's nice like to see certain people show their asses where it's like the ones like one of the few silver linings of this whole thing is seeing like Ben Affleck just make a fool of himself and Matt Damon make a fool of himself.
Yeah.
Just these two gross Boston bros.
Bloated. Ugh, they're gross. Disgusting. Although I did like Good Will Hunting. I stand by that.
Yeah, but it turns out that they like another
oh, that's right.
secret is that like they like basically
a
rumor is that the script was completely rewritten from the one that they
submitted or whatever because
yeah.
it was like terrible. Yeah, so moral of the story, again, everybody stop talking. Talk only if you have something good to say. And
or if you have something interesting to say.
Good or interesting. I would prefer, I guess I would take interesting over good.
Yeah.
And check yourself before you
touch
check yourself.
A lady who doesn't want to be touched.
Don't touch women who don't want to be touched.
Or men.
Or literally anyone. If don't touch anyone that doesn't want to be touched. It's really
stop
simple.
Stop fucking winking at people, Woody Allen.
On Oops the Podcast, join me, comedian Giulio Gallerati, as I examine everyday life, the mistakes, the bad decisions, the goals, the jokes, the social engagements, and all things in between. I'm joined every week by producer and personal confidant Ryan Lynch, various other comedians, for witty, candid, and intoxicating conversation. Our listeners love Oops for sophisticated banter, aka your mom could listen, and many feel like they're in the room with us chopping it up with old pals. You can find every episode of the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube.
So our guest today has been by before. We invited her back because she's just a wealth of knowledge.
And a treat.
We haven't reached the end of her knowledge yet, so we will keep just using her.
It is endless.
In time, we will reach the end.
I doubt it.
We have with us a staff writer. She is also the curator of our subsite Pictorial, which kind of is just ephemera from past decades. It's really cool. It's one of the only things I read on the internet, not just Jezebel. We have with us Kelly Faircloth. Hi, Kelly.
Thanks for having me back.
Of course. Of course. And we have Kelly here to talk about the history of the casting couch.
Something that's been, just because of the Weinstein fallout, it's been in the news a lot. Mm-hmm. Kind of this idea of actresses who have, the rumors say have maybe slept their way into roles, that type of thing. Kelly has actually been working on a longer piece about this, and just about the history of the casting couch, which is really interesting. And it's a concept that I think is worth digging deeper on because it is a very sexist one, and it's like abusive at worst, career damaging at best. And I know one reason I've been thinking about this a lot is George Clooney, when he was asked about Harvey Weinstein, released what was maybe the only decent "I didn't know what was going on" statement, even though I'm not sure if I believe it entirely.
Right.
But he told the Daily Beast, "I've heard rumors, and the rumors in general started back in the 90s, and they were that certain actresses had slept with Harvey to get a role. It seemed like a way to smear the actresses and demean them by saying that they didn't get their jobs based on their talent. So I took those rumors with a grain of salt." So I kind of want to throw it to you, Ms. Faircloth, to discuss sort of how actresses have historically been associated with the casting couch.
Yeah, it's interesting because there's actually a much longer history at work here than just even the history of the film industry. It goes back several hundred years, just sort of in Western history, and specifically like in, you know, in London and Paris. I mean, traditionally, like women who were in the theater were very like stigmatized and very sort of assumed to be sexually available. And the stereotype was that basically a theater was like a brothel. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a lot of interesting sort of ins and outs to that. I spoke to Kristen Pollan, who's a professor at the University of Illinois, the author of this book called Actresses and Whores, about sort of the history of this like complex association between women in the theater and you know, presumed sexual availability and sex work. And a lot of times, you know, traditionally, like when we're going back to when women first started appearing in the theater, like the theater is dominated by people from the working class. Women from the working classes are not afforded the same protections and you know, they don't have those protections of like presumed like chivalry or you know, or men don't feel obligated to offer them the same treatment. But then there's also this other sort of flip side to it where like you're a successful, adventurous woman who has what it takes to make it on stage. Maybe you are generally more adventurous, and maybe you do, you know, the Marquess of whatever comes to you and says, "I think you're a beautiful, charming woman. I'm a fascinating man. Maybe let's, you know, would you like me to shower you in jewels?" And it's like, you know, what else are you going to do in, you know, 1750?
We've all seen Moulin Rouge.
Yes, we all have seen Moulin Rouge. On the hand, oh, my continental, but diamonds are a girl's best friend. Basically, if you've seen Moulin Rouge,
then you know it. You get it.
Yeah, you know exactly as much as Kelly.
But like you have like, you know, like you especially see this in the Restoration when after Cromwell, like they put Charles II on the throne after chopping off his dad's head. They have all these years of like Puritan rule. Then they put Charles II back on the throne. And basically it's like just a huge party for decades. Okay. And he has so many mistresses. Like you go to the National, like the Portrait Gallery in London. And it's just, there's this entire room that's just like mistress, 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 mistress. And one of them is this woman, Nell Gwynn, who's like this brilliant, beautiful, witty actress.
Yeah,
like,
that name definitely rings a bell. Mm-hmm.
Pretty witty Nellie Gwynn is what Samuel Pepys called her. You know, it's interesting because there's like this interesting phenomenon where to some extent it's that women have this set of cultural scripts put on them because they aren't living conventional lives. And to some extent it's also that just due to the way that society is structured and where they're coming from, I mean, they are more sort of vulnerable to exploitation and like their labor conditions are, you know, are really tough and like, you know, there's not a lot of protections for them. And, you know, this professor told me that in fact, men could like pay extra with their ticket to go backstage and hang out and like basically get backstage passes to where, you know, women were like doing the work of being actresses and changing clothes and socializing. And so it's this very complicated set of phenomena that over the years you end up having this very long running association between like actresses and women of the theater and sex.
It's really interesting and just sad that what you're saying, like their class made them vulnerable maybe to these projections and also to these realities. Whereas, you know, upper class women had chaperones and had all of this stuff. But mm-hmm. like either way, it's just their sexuality being policed in a way that is like mm-hmm. beyond their control. And mm-hmm. that is gross. And being a woman is cool.
It's hard and fun.
Yeah. It's, you know, the dresses look great, but otherwise being a woman in history is
The clothes are garbage. Awesome, but basically, everything else is shit. So.
Basically, the whole TLDR on that deal.
Yeah, yeah, man. So this, we're like jumping forward 100 years, mm-hmm. give or take, to basically the studio era of Hollywood, where mm-hmm. studios basically, if you were on a contract with them, they essentially owned you. Mm-hmm. And that sometimes worked out well in that they would cover up crimes for you if you happened to be a guy. Mm-hmm. And also sometimes that did not work out so well. And one of these cases was really widely publicized actually more recently than it was at the time, where a woman, Patricia Douglas, was raped at a party where studio accountants and studio, you know, financiers were kind of invited to just have sex with this row of actresses. And the documentary about her is called Girl 27.
They were the whole vocabulary of bad woman, slut, tart, tramp, everything came up immediately if anybody mentioned she was raped.
All the women had a number and hers was mm-hmm. 27. Mm-hmm. And she's just the one whose rape was publicized eventually. Mm-hmm. You know, there's at least 26 other girls at that party who I'm sure mm-hmm. not all of them were there to, like, have a good time. Mm-hmm. But because of the way the studio system worked, they just sort of had to show up and they were expected to just, like, fuck these old rich dudes because that's what was promised when they came to visit mm-hmm. the studios is, like, you're going to get to mix and mingle mm-hmm. with these hot young things.
And, like, just to drop back to sort of, like, the beginning of the motion picture industry in Hollywood. And at first, you know, women actually end up in more roles than you might think. They have more power behind the screen initially, like, sort of in the early, early days before the studio system really takes hold, like, in the 20s. And it's interesting because at the sort of same time you have, like, all these young women flooding from the country into cities and, like, going to work and all these new jobs. They're working at department stores and they're working in offices and they're, you know, they're taking over, like, as secretaries and sort of there's this new move of, like, young women taking on these new jobs, and there's all this cultural anxiety that's happening. And then in Hollywood, it's a boom town for women. Like, you know, there's all sorts of women, and like there's female screenwriters and female, you know, actresses and costume ladies and, you know,
editors too, and, just, you know,
mm-hmm, all these new jobs. And what's interesting is you do start to see all this concern. You know, another professor I spoke to, Hillary Hallett, she said, you know, you start to see all this concern about the prospect of all these, you know, young women trading sex for work. And how much of that is sort of, it's a question how much that was actually happening. Because a lot of the thing that, you know, I've really noticed about this is that it's really hard to pin down details because it's sort of just this idea, this nebulous, oh, you know, did you hear about so-and-so? So-and-so didn't do the casting couch, so she, you know, washed out. So-and-so, you know, oh, did you hear so-and-so did, you know? But it seems like to me, you know, sort of the golden age of the term and when sort of you have the system that makes it most likely is the studio system. You know, it concentrates the power in the hands of, like, key men, basically. And, you know, they basically, it really does turn into this system where they can offer you more, but also, you know, they have more power, so they can deny you more, and, like, they could cover up anything, apparently.
Right. They, like, literally covered up murders.
Yeah, it's like, and the Girl 27 thing is a good, that documentary is a good example. It's like, she wasn't going to go quietly.
No.
But they won in the end.
I mean, they snuffed her out.
Yeah.
We are
the real Brady Bros.
Brady Brothers from the TV show Brady Bunch. I'm Barry Williams.
And I'm Christopher Knight.
I played Greg. And who are you again?
I played Peter. We've decided that we're going to do a podcast around episodes of the Brady Bunch. We're going to use it as a prism to look back to our experience doing the show and why the Brady Bunch is still popular.
Have a sunshine day.
We are the real Brady Bros.
There's also a crazy story that you and I, Kelly, have talked about this book, Kenneth Anger's Hollywood Babylon.
Oh, Hollywood Babylon.
There's a story I first read there. And the thing with Hollywood Babylon is that it is very interesting. But Kenneth Anger, who is also a director, very clearly hates women so much.
Cool.
And so there's a lot of things in there that you kind of have to take with a grain of salt because he talks.
A salt mine, probably.
Yeah, exactly. Or he says things like, oh, you know, like this actress who was basically portrayed as like a very, very much like the blushing virgin in movies. He's like, she was just a whore fucking everybody, mm-hmm. you know, and this one who was sort of a vamp, she actually was like an uptight prude.
Yeah.
But one story he actually gets fairly wrong in his book is the one of Fatty Arbuckle that ruined his career pretty much, which is that. Again, at another Hollywood party organized by some studio heads, a young woman was killed. So she died, I think, a few days after. But the way the story went at first was that after sharing a few drinks with Fatty Arbuckle, who was very much like the comedic star of the century, he was a huge fucking deal. So it's like, I think I've heard this analogy before, so I'm like, don't want to just plagiarize someone, but like, say like Will Ferrell was accused of,
okay,
you know, killing somebody. It was like a big deal. The way that her friend, whose name is Maud Delmont, she is kind of a known Hollywood madam, describes it, is that after having a few drinks with Fatty Arbuckle, this woman, her name is Virginia Rapp, a young actress, very pretty. After a few drinks with Fatty, he pulls her into a room. A few minutes later, Maud hears screaming. She pounds on the door to kick it down. It's locked. Finally, Fatty Arbuckle opens it in his pajamas, wearing this young woman, Virginia's hat, askew on his head, and, like, looking all goofy while she's on the bed just moaning in agony. She's taken to the hospital. Within a week, she has died of a ruptured bladder. And so newspapers loved this story, and they just ran with it super hard. And the whole thing was that Fatty Arbuckle had basically crushed her with his weight while raping her. And that's what crushed her bladder. What actually happened, well, and then also this woman, Maud, the madam, she talked to anyone who would listen. Her story changed a lot. In some, she had just met Virginia. In others, they were really old friends. It was very unreliable, but the newspapers just ate it up. But meanwhile, when it actually went to court, it was like, basically it took like a 5-minute deliberation of the jury where they're like, he has an alibi. None of this checks out. And it's one of the rare cases where that's true. Like, he was not really in the same room as her for the most part. Kind of everything actually seems legit in that Fatty Arbuckle did not
like crush this woman to death.
This poor girl.
By raping her.
But it ruined his career. He never worked for the most part again, which like sucks for him.
Yeah.
But you like think of the culture that allowed this like young girl to go to this party surrounded by all these strangers and like not be able to like get help as she's dying? I don't know. The whole thing is just obviously so upsetting.
I mean, it's it's extremely upsetting, but I mean, and I would say that the fact that Fatty, Mr. Arbuckle, I don't know, just calling him Fatty feels rude.
Yes.
That is technically his name. I mean, the fact that he was eventually, his career was ruined because of this is obviously like sad for his career or whatever, but I don't think that that's, given the more modern cases of bad men in Hollywood being accused of doing terrible things, even if they have or if they haven't done them, they continue to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think the difference is that everyone like kind of has to get on board with believing something where it's like with, say, Woody Allen and the accusations surrounding sexual assault and him, it's like there are still so many people who are convinced that he didn't do it. You know, it's like,
that's true.
That's, I think, where like the wiggle room happens.
You do have to scare up enough. Everyone has to be united on either one.
I mean, I think what's interesting about the context of the Fatty Arbuckle thing is, you know, this is what I found when I've sort of been looking into sort of the progression of sort of the idea of this trope. You know, there was just so much like cultural concern in the early 20s about like, our girls. Like, you know, there's like, you see this in so many different ways. You see this in the flappers. You see this in like, you know, eugenics type, like scientific racism. You see it in like all these places where sort of this anxiety about like what's happening to our girls. Like you see it. And, you know, I think it played really well to a lot of anxieties for, you know, the newspapers to just be like, oh, you know, basically to be like, look at Hollywood Babylon, look at Sodom and Gomorrah. Like, part of what was happening is that, like, actually, you know, like, women could go out there and make a living.
Right.
I think if there's one thing that we've learned from the heart, like, the you know, the stories of the last week, it's that, like, there probably were people moving in the early film industry who were, like, predatory. But, like, I think that that's probably true because that seems to be unfortunate, like, you know.
Universal truth.
Yeah, Joanna did that article recently that was, like, you know, where can I go to work that's, you know, and it's, like, you know, Antarctica, beekeeping. It's like, you know, I mean,
everything.
I'm not making any specific allegations about beekeeping, but like, that's what's interesting about it to me is that we have this trope about Hollywood that there's the casting couch. And I think that it's this weird concept that does a lot of heavy lifting culturally because it simultaneously acknowledges the potential for sexual abuse. It reframes sexual abuse as a question of like what the woman did. And it also has this sort of power to question the achievements of women to be like, oh, you know, is she a casting couch case? And so it's like, you know, he can offer you favors. You say, yeah, but like, how do you, you know, like you're what, like a 19-year-old kid from Kansas? Like, how do you say no to a studio head? You know, it's like, to me, it's this like really weird, complicated sort of like, I don't know. I think it's a very like toxic trope, honestly.
Well, and I think you just hit the nail on the head in that it sort of shows how these things feed each other where one, another thing is, like, if you make Hollywood Sodom and Gomorrah, that absolves you as a small-town person, even though there are people everywhere who are willing to take advantage of other people, you know? So it's, like, it's not like these girls, like, had no chance of ever being harmed if they just stayed home and, you know, acted like good wives, which I'm sure that was being said back then, where it's like, if they just learned their boundaries, you know?
Like, you learned a lesson by going to try to, like, make something of yourself in Hollywood. Like, this is what you get.
But, like, God knows if you, like, picked the wrong husband in your small town in 1919, like, who's going to protect you from that? Like, there's not even marital rape laws at this point. Like, you know, that's not even considered. There's all these abuses, and it's just fascinating to me that, like, you have this idea of the casting couch in, like, the 40s and 50s, and it's like, like, it seems to me that, you know, part of what the work that thing is doing is it's implicating women.
Yeah, it's like you made this choice to go there. That's so sad. I don't know. I feel like that attitude then probably did in some weird way empower these studio heads where it's like, if, like, the rest of the world is just like, ooh, these guys have all the power in the world, look what they can do, then you're going to start believing that about yourself where it's just like, yeah, I mean, let's show you Hollywood Babylon. Like, let's show you how great it is and, you know, that type of thing. So,
I mean, honestly, like, you know, what was striking to me is, like, if you had, like, sat down and designed a system to, like, provide cover for abuses, like, honestly, I think you'd be hard-pressed to design something better than the studio system, which, like, just incredible the amount of power to, like, make or break people that these guys had.
I mean, and it went beyond sexual harassment. It also went into union busting, and it went into racism, and it went into, you know, not that any of those things are exclusive from one another.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because, and I want you to actually get into this because you have the quote from, I believe, the 40s that is very good.
I found this quote from Modern Screen Magazine in 1941. It's sort of about this, you know, report from the Hollywood scene or whatever. It's like, we're going to tell you how Hollywood really is. And it, deep in the piece, it says, "The day of the quote-unquote casting couch, when a girl had to exercise her libido instead of her talent for a job, is almost dead. The much-publicized and traditional Hollywood orgy died that evening when Fatty Arbuckle became involved in the community's most colossal scandal, which meant the end of Virginia rap. Today, Hollywood parties are pretty dull and business-like affairs, where Daryl Zanuck is talking about himself and boring Joe Pasternak would like to talk about himself, and where Jack Benny won't talk at all for fear of losing a gag to Bob Hope and Ken Murray, who are also silent." Now, what's interesting about this quote is that it's from 1941. The case, the party where Patricia Douglas was, that was in 1937. So that was 4 years ago when this was written. And also, Daryl Zanuck is one of the names you kind of hear. And again, it's like, you know, you don't hear a lot of specific allegations. It is kind of like the way people would talk about, you know, Weinstein in the comments of Lainey gossip or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it is like he's one of the people who gets named as like having an active casting couch. And in fact, like yesterday at the Daily Mail, Joan Collins just did a piece saying that she was warned about him by Marilyn Monroe and that then he, you know, tried it with her. Like he like put the moves on her. So it's like, I think what is really interesting about this is you sort of see the casting couch evoked to be like, oh, I remember the crazy old days of Hollywood in the 20s with Fatty Arbuckle and the old Hollywood orgy. That's done today. And it's like, it's not at all. And I think that it actually is kind of a warning for us because it's like, you know, oh, like, whoo, you know, we got that solved. And it's like, it's very easy to like pin it on a specific person. But I think that, you know, there's a lot of like widespread evaluating of attitudes that have to happen in order to like actually get the job done this time instead of us looking back in 20 years and being like, well, thank God that's done. You know, it's
Like the Zanucks are still a really powerful family in film. Like they still are really like living off those riches.
So what other things did you find in your reporting?
I think there's also like a fetish dimension to the way we talk about the casting couch.
Oh, definitely. Oh, yeah. 100%.
Like the first instance I found of the term was this like 1924 stag film, which is like early softcore pornography called The Casting Couch.
Mm.
And another thing I came across was there was this, you know, 1963 article from the like kind of like down market Playboy competitor called Jim. And it was like, you know, this article that's like a new look at the old casting couch. And it's, you know, a picture of a naked, of a woman's butt, you know, a naked woman's butt. And it's like, and I think that it does also kind of become this like lascivious joke thing that's like, oh, the old, you know, the old casting couch. Like it's kind of has this like lecherous air, the whole idea, which is also like gross on its, on a whole additional level.
Yeah. I mean, very, very much like these like pretty but desperate young women who are willing to do anything with these disgusting ghouls who are just, like, so rich and powerful that they can... It's like Jabba the Hutt and Princess Leia, where it's like they can make you dance for them. But, you know...
And I get the impression that it's, like a porn trope, like, even now.
I think
like,
it still is. That's what I was gonna... Is what the porn that I was thinking of, this is terrible, that I even... Bang Bus is kind of, like...
Yeah, right.
Of like a casting. It's kind of playing off of that trope. And if I'm anyone who's listening, please correct me if I'm wrong. Bang Bus. It's like there's a bus, the Bang Bus, right?
Yes.
And there's women, like younger porn stars, who come onto this thing as if they were like strangers, and then they fuck the dudes that are on the bus.
Oftentimes, they like will pick up somebody.
They'll pick up like someone else. They'll pick up like one, and they'll pick up another.
Yeah.
And then they'll fuck on the bus.
Yes.
For like the idea of like some sort of this perhaps, I mean, part of that is like the perceived anonymity of like those people being strangers, but it's also like a weird sort of like fuck your way to fame.
Yeah. Like, do you think she'll make it in the real porn industry?
Yeah. It's another gross thing that I thought about, but I'm pretty sure that the casting couch in some iteration is still around in porn.
And in life.
And in life, yeah. People are still being asked to, like, suck a dick for a job.
So, ladies, if you wanna suck someone's dick...
You can.
I do not judge you.
Nope.
You can, I mean, I might judge like your choice in man, but I don't judge the dick sucking.
Or yeah, the action. I have no judgment.
If this
no
is fun for you and you want to go for it,
please.
Yes.
Great.
If you don't really want to do it, but you feel like you have to, I'm sorry.
So yeah,
there are systems out there.
Also, tips at Jezebel.com.
Tips at Jezebel.com. We would love to tell your story.
I'd love to hear it. Yep.
But also, we would like to
extend
live in a world where you feel empowered enough not to do that because you're a talented person.
Set the casting couch on fire.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's worth pointing out, too, that this is not to say that, like, actresses are lucky, but in that, like, being in the public eye, there is way more of a platform for people to listen and sympathize with these women who are coming forward, as they should be listened to and sympathized with.
Mm-hmm.
But as you were saying, where it was, like, easy to pin all this shit on Hollywood, mm-hmm. it happens everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very much like, oh, look at, you know, these capitalists and their, you know, mm-hmm. fucking Hollywood Hills pieces of shit.
Yeah.
But it's just, like, every industry has this to a certain extent. Every mm-hmm. single one. As you said, like, beekeeping. Antarctica.
Yeah.
The industry of Antarctica.
The Antarctica industry.
Yeah,
that
you
one.
Know. Ice mining.
Penguins.
Like, all of these industries have it, but the people who come forward don't have nearly anything close to the mouthpieces that these public figures have. And so it's interesting, one, that actresses have kind of always been associated with being prostitutes mm-hmm. or being sex workers.
Mm-hmm.
And then also that this is pervasive and is everywhere. And that's not necessarily true for secretaries, but there are definitely tropes about secretaries and that mm-hmm. type of thing where just, like, women can't catch a fucking break.
Yeah. Really cannot, apparently.
Yeah.
Except for in media.
Yeah, we're doing fine. We're doing just great.
Kelly takes a gulp of water.
It's fine.
Thank you so much for listening to Dirtcast, and thank you to Kelly Faircloth. Our show is produced by Levi Sharp with editorial oversight by Kate Dreese. Manana Mofidi is our executive director of audio. Our theme music is by Stuart Wood. This episode was mixed by Jamie Collazo. Want to send us a tip or just let us know what you think? Hit us up at dirtcast@jezebel.com. Please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts.